I'm going to talk today about the Triple Gem, which is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which I can't remember the last time I gave a talk on it. I know I touch on it, especially at New Year's, because we offer the opportunity to take the refuges at New Year's intention setting, and we talk about it on retreat and sometimes in day-longs, and I reference it, but I haven't really spent time going into it, so that's what I wanted to do, because I think it's really helpful, and it's for me, when I think about taking the refuges, I often think of it as putting on a comfortable overcoat on a cold day. It's just this feeling that's like, it's like a nice relief, and when I say taking refuge, it means, in this sense, committing yourself to the path of awakening, committing yourself to the path of liberation. And it's the refuges are taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And so I just want to go over those a little bit. Refuge in the Buddha is taking refuge in his liberation and taking refuge in the idea that, or the recognition that he was a human being, he wasn't a deity, and he was able to find this freedom, and that it therefore is available to each and every one of us, if we, kind of follow his path, not necessarily exactly his path. He spent 7 years studying with different teachers, some of whom were ascetics, and it was not actually a very good path. But then he stopped and sat down and said, I'm gonna sit here. And he sat in meditation until he had this awakening, this awareness, this clarity around the nature of suffering, dukkha, discontent, and the way out of that cycle of that hamster wheel of doing the same thing over and over and over again, thinking it's going to be different this time. And so he lived in a way that developed these qualities of clarity, of compassion, of patience, of generosity. There's many, many teachings about the different qualities that are necessary. And he also spent 45 years teaching after his awakening. And he taught kings, and he taught paupers, and he taught everybody in between. His teachings were taught in a way so that it was accessible to anybody who was interested in moving towards freedom and getting unstuck, so to speak. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is this wonderful teacher who I really admire a lot, and who's quite a scholar and has done a lot of translation of the suttas. He's put together an anthology of discourses on the from the Pali Canon on social and communal harmony. And in that book, he says, talking about, I think that's where I got this from. He says, confidence in the Buddha as our refuge is initially awakened when we contemplate his sublime virtues and his excellent teaching. It grows through our undertaking of the training. At first, our confidence in the Buddha may be hesitant, punctured by doubts and perplexity. But as we apply ourselves to the practice of his path, we find that our defilements, greed, hatred, ignorance gradually lessen, and that the wholesome qualities increase. And with this comes a growing sense of freedom, peace, and joy. And what that points to as well is that these refuges are not, as with so many teachings, they're not these discrete units that kind of stand alone, but they support each other. Just as the different factors of the Eightfold Path support each other, just as the different qualities of the heart, the Brahmaviharas support each other, these refuges support each other. So we take refuge in the Buddha, trusting that if this person could do it, then we can do it. In fact, he said, I wouldn't teach it if I didn't think it was possible for you. And when he was dying, his disciples said, what are we going to do now? What are we going to do now? And he's like, hey, I just spent 45 years telling you what to do. You know, find your way with this. You know, see for yourself, ehipasiko, see for yourself what takes you away from suffering, what takes you towards suffering. So he laid down the teachings, which is often called the Dharma, which leads us into the second refuge, which is taking refuge in the Dharma. And the Dharma actually has a couple of understandings, a way it's understood. The first is the teachings, the Four Noble Truths, this understanding of what suffering is, what dukkha is, and the recognition that there's a way out of that. And the Eightfold Path is this way to live that takes us away from this hamster wheel and takes us toward an existence that's ease, that's equanimity, that's a path towards equanimity, basically. And it's kind of this natural next step. If we say, okay, this person, now what did he do? Oh, the Dharma. Let me see what those teachings say. And as I said, he taught to multiple types of people over multiple years. And so there's an access point for many, many people from many, many different directions. So that's one of the ways to understand refuge in the Dharma, is just taking refuge in these teachings. Saying, you know what? This is what's going to take me. This is the path. And the other understanding of Dharma, which I think is also incredibly important, is to recognize, is taking refuge in the present moment. It's taking refuge in reality. It's being fully present with what's right here, right now, without any dust in our eyes. Right now, it's like this. That's my favorite saying. It's like, what's happening right now, and can I be with it? Like in the meditation this evening, I was inviting you to rest in being. Just rest in being right here. It may be comfortable, it may be uncomfortable. How do you greet this moment? And recognizing that we are only right here. We can't be any other place. I've often thought I could be two places at once. I've tried being a busy person. I try and figure out how I can be more than one place at once, but I have never succeeded. Even the idea of multitasking is false. Because we can't. I mean, we're not going to do them well. We can do a couple things at a time, but I've learned that they don't always both get done well. So to recognize that we just have this, and can we be with it? Again, this is necessary for liberation, to be fully present. And La Sarmiento, who's a teacher, they used to live back east. I don't know if they still do. La Sarmiento said, be with yourself however you are. Be with yourself however you are. Right now it's like this. I may not be, you know, I probably have still some unskillful qualities and I behave in unskillful ways, but I'm committing to this path. I'm committing to the teachings. I'm committing to walking in a particular way and just seeing myself fully how I am, you know, without the blinders that we've developed because of our conditioning. We have to see clearly so we can let go of things that get in our way. All that conditioning, the familial conditioning, the societal conditioning, you know? And I have this line that, I don't know if it's a quote from someone, and if it's a quote, I've lost the attribution many years ago. But I love this line. It says, I stand with being at peace with whatever arises. You know, it's not that I condone injustice. That's not what it means. It's like, okay, right now it's like this. Right now it's greeting reality front on. Like I say, no one ever wins a fist fight with reality. So can I say hello to reality? And that's equanimity. That's an undefended heart, and that's equanimity. And then the next refuge. So refuge in the Dharma is refuge in the teachings and refuge in awakening this moment, being right here, fully present. What is the line? You must be present to win. and they have door prizes, and it's like you must be present to win this idea of win the freedom from discontent and dukkha. And the next refuge is refuge in the Sangha, and Sangha is generally translated as community. And originally, the Sangha meant the community of monks and nuns that the Buddha created back in his day, the monastics. And the monastics were those who studied, who taught the word of the Buddha, and they were supported by the lay community. So it eventually came to be known as the fourfold Sangha, the Sangha of men and women, supported by lay community of men and women, and in that binary way of looking at it. So it's this monastic and lay people, and they are the Sangha. And I like what Bhikkhu Bodhi said around this, and he says it's a community of people who are also on this path. It's not just random people, but it's people of community the community of people who are also on this path, and a community of people who it's safe to be around because they're also dedicated to the precepts. And the precepts are non-harming, cultivation of compassion and kindness, you know, wise in speech. They don't take what's not offered, and they cultivate generosity. They're mindful. They don't ingest things that lead to heedlessness. They're fully present or working towards that. You know, they're working on this path. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says that we are our personal transformation. And this practice, as it's come to the West, has come to be seen, or has come to oftentimes be this practice of personal transformation and personal liberation, which it is, but our personal transformation and all personal liberation is the key to societal transformation. So because we have to see clearly. And we do it not just for our own benefit, but we do it for the benefit of all beings. In later schools of thought, there's the idea of the bodhisattva who foregoes their final liberation, their final awakening, to make sure that everybody is brought along. You know, beings are numberless. I vow to save them. You know, suffering is endless. I vow to end suffering. You know, there's this vow of just taking it all on, because they recognize that we don't exist in isolation. In our society, in our Western capitalist society, we think we do. It's, you know, this rugged individualism, but we don't. We can't. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. And so this personal training is the key to our transformation, and also the key to societal transformation. Bhikkhu Bodhi said, again, the Buddha placed special emphasis on wise choice of friends, which he saw as having a profound influence on one's individual development, as well as on the creation of a harmonious and ethically upright community. Good friendship is essential, not only because it benefits us in times of trouble, satisfies our social instincts, and enlarges our sphere of concern from the self to others. It is critical because good friendship plants in us the sense of discretion, the ability to distinguish between good and bad, right and wrong, and to choose the honorable over the expedient. Therefore, the Buddha says that all good qualities unfold from good friendship. In fact, there's a very famous sutta where the Buddha and Ananda, his assistant, were talking, and Ananda said something about spiritual friendship being half the holy life, and the Buddha said it is the whole of the holy life. This necessity to have these friends, these people that we practice with, who are like-minded, who are walking in the same direction. And I want to read just a short sutta that talks about the qualities. And this is, you know, this is 2,600 years ago, And it's just as valid today. The Buddha in the Swan Sutta says there's four kinds of good friends. He's talking to this young man. And he says, there's a helpful friend who protects you when you're heedless, who looks after your property when you're not paying attention. He is a refuge when you are frightened. And when some need arises, he gives you twice the wealth required. A friend who shares one happiness and suffering reveals his secrets to you and guards your secrets, does not abandon you when you are in trouble, and he would even sacrifice his life for your sake. A friend who points out what is good can be understood. He restrains you from evil. He enjoins you in the good. He informs you of what you have not heard, and he points out to you the path to heaven. And finally, a sympathetic friend does not rejoice in your misfortune. He rejoices in your good fortune. He stops those who speak poorly of you, and he commends those who speak praise of you. So it's someone who has your back, basically, who calls you on your shit and has your back, which is a wise friend. And so that is the spiritual, they talk about Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship. That is the Sangha we want to take refuge in. And as I said, in the countries that have the traditional practice that Buddhism has gone back hundreds and thousands of years, there's the monastic community, which is very well established, and the lay community, which supports it. And they support each other in this symbiotic relationship. But as Buddhism moved to the West, originally the original Buddhist communities in the early 19th century were Chinese immigrants who brought their temples and their practice with them, and then later Japanese. But in more recent times, we have a lot of Westerners who went over to Southwest Asia, to Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, and others who brought back these teachings, and it became a very lay community here. So the monastic tradition is not as strong, especially in the insight community, in the Vipassana, in the older, it's still very strong in more ethnic communities, but in the convert, so to speak, convert Buddhism, it's less. And what we have to recognize also in this idea, so this idea of lay sangha is very strong in the West and Vipassana and insight tradition. And what we also have to recognize, and this is especially important, and I was thinking about this earlier today, it's like, just because you're in a spiritual community doesn't mean it's safe. And we've seen this over and over and over again. I mean, over and across the board. I mean, we have, there's Buddhist tradition, in all the lineages, there's a very strong patriarchy. And a lot of times, even female nuns takes our second class status to monks, I mean, to this very day. So that is not necessarily a safe space. And then here in the West, we have to recognize the societal conditioning and patriarchy and racism and economic injustice and all those things, those biases that we bring into the Sangha with us. So we have to name those and recognize those as part of this conditioning that we have to work on, to recognize that. We can't just go in and say, oh, I'm going to meditate and it's all going to be good. We have to recognize these deep systemic biases that make sanghas not safe for people. So that, we have all of that. I think sometimes people think, oh, Buddhism, that's because we're always yearning for the perfect thing. And it's like, oh, they're perfect. The Buddhists are killing Muslims in Myanmar. So it's not necessarily you know, safe for certain people. So to recognize that, but also recognizing those biases and the conditioning that we have to work with, and also recognizing the importance of creating a safe community. And a safe community can just be a few people. You know, it can be some people that you trust who've walked this path before you, who can share, people you're walking this path with, like that sutta I read, people who will call you on your shit and who have your back, which is really, really important. And it's really important. And Lama Rod Owens talks about how he said we can't do the work of the world until we have something to hold us. This is where we can let our hearts break wide open because we feel held. So we need this place, this sangha, this community that holds us. But we also have to have our eyes wide open and make sure we're in the community that's a safe space for us. And don't just assume that just because it's X, Y, or Z, it's safe. We have to, you know, where are they with the precepts? You know, or the walk in the walk, talk in the talk, you know, whatever that is. Walking the walk, not just talking the talk. You know, so it's all part and parcel of it. So the Buddha taught this beautiful idea of Sangha and doing the work on the path, which allows us to wake up to suffering and injustice and to create a community that supports our awakening. And I really love, I really love the Buddhist teachings. I love the idea of what he talks about in the Eightfold Path, because and in so many of the teachings, the Metta Sutta talks about, we have to, you know, we offer, we're kind to all beings, omitting none. That's so plain. And we have to see what gets in the way. I say that a lot. We have to see what gets in the way, and that's what we work on, and we create communities that allow us to work on that and allow us to be right where we are and see it all. See the blemishes, see the unskillful behavior, see where we've conditioned to cause suffering and cause harm, and work on walking away from that. So anyway, that is, I think, that's probably all I have to say, but refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, I think it's a really helpful reflection on how to hold this and to find those folks that will support you and walk this path with you, this community, and to recognize our interconnectedness. We can't do this alone. We cannot do this alone. I think last week I read that quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson about how, Neil deGrasse Tyson, yeah, how we're all stardust. We are all interconnected. We're all in this together, and we get to support each other. Because all beings, omitting none, all beings, omitting none. So thank you so much, my friends, for your very kind attention. And I hope you find refuge in the Triple Gem as well.
Thank you for visiting Undefended Dharma. These teachings are freely offered. However, if you would like to make a donation to help support the technology that makes these podcasts possible, please visit marystankavich.org/support. Thank you.